Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is the producer of today's program. We at the Old Mole are dedicated to offering a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and LGBTQ-positive analysis of culture, politics, and current events. Today on our program, Sarah Chivers talks with essential worker Anthony Carter about working during the recent heat wave. Bill Resnick will conclude the program today talking to Jo Marie Burt of the Washington Office on Latin America about the ominous situation in Peru. Leading off, Lori Mercier speaks with award-winning foreign correspondent Stefan Kinzer about his corpus of work that traces in detail the history of U.S. military and CIA interventions around the world, how the economic interests that drive the U.S. empire direct resources that might be directed to eradicating poverty and other productive uses, as well as the robust tradition of American public opposition to these interventions. Stefan Kinzer is currently a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and a world affairs columnist for the Boston Globe, and is the author of many books about U.S. interventions, including his best-selling Overthrow America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, and more recently, The True Flag, about the birth of the American Empire. You can follow his work on Twitter and at stefankinzer.com.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Stefan Kinzer, a former award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of a tremendous corpus of work that traces in detail U.S. interventions around the world. Some of his books include Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, The Brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles in their secret world war, The True Flag about the birth of the American Empire, and most recently, Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA search for mind control. Kinzer has taught journalism and international relations at Northwestern and Boston universities. He is now a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and writes a world affairs column for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Stefan Kinzer.
Well, after all that, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today on KBOO. A few months ago, after President Biden called Russian President Vladimir Putin a killer, Putin responded, "It takes one to know one," which the international press applauded because the rest of the world acknowledges the willful ignorance of most Americans to the long history of U.S. interventions in elections, overthrowing democracies, and initiating or sustaining wars around the globe. Let's talk about the origins of these interventions, drawing from your recent book, The True Flag. What is the significance of 1898 and the debates that occurred then about the U.S. role in the world?
Well, thanks for giving me the chance to talk about that, because it puts some great questions into the right perspective. So I was a foreign correspondent for many years. I worked for the New York Times in dozens of different countries, and I had a chance to watch history unfold right in front of me. After years of doing that, I began to wonder, what did it all mean? How does it all fit together? How did this start? In particular, where did the United States get this idea that we're in charge of the world? And if anything bad is happening, as we define bad, we have to intervene. No other country in the world has intervened so often in so many countries, so far away from its own borders over such a long period of time as the United States. So why is this? Now, the traditional answer was that it came after the end of World War II. Europe was devastated. We had the emergence of the Soviet Union. And Americans decided that the world was going to go into chaos if we didn't save it. But the more I began to look into the history of that era and the history of the whole 20th century, the more I concluded that was actually wrong, and that we didn't get into the business of trying to rule other countries after World War II. It actually happened earlier. It happened in the period around 1898, when the United States first seized its overseas territories like the Philippines and Puerto Rico. We took responsibility for Cuba. It was the beginning of the overseas empire. And what I found so fascinating in researching this period is that the debate over whether the United States should do this, whether a country dedicated to self-determination that had itself rebelled against an overseas imperialist colony could now become a colonizer and take over other countries. So this debate unfolded in the United States Senate over a period of about 5 weeks at the beginning of 1899. Everybody in the Senate was fully aware that they weren't just debating a treaty about whether to take the Philippines and Puerto Rico. They were debating the whole future of the United States. They all understood that, as one senator said, once we take this step, there's no going back to just being a country that minds our own business. So I found that period fantastically interesting. And since all my books are efforts to tell untold stories, stories that were really important in history, but that for whatever reason have been left behind, I jumped on that one, and that's what became The True Flag.
And of course, that part of the importance of that story, as you alluded to, is the fact that this is long before any Cold War, which justified so many interventions after World War II, as you pointed out. And there was a great deal of pushback. And in your book, you discuss the Anti-Imperialist League. Do you want to say something about that group?
One reason I was so interested in writing that book, The True Flag, is that I wanted to inform people today who are working towards reconciliation and peace with other nations and who oppose U.S. interventions and wars and bombing abroad that this is not a new idea. This is not a radical idea. In fact, this is an idea that's deeply rooted in American history. The people who are against American interventions in foreign wars today are standing on the shoulders of titans. I wanted to convey this sense that there have been generations of people in the United States that have fervently opposed this idea that the United States has come up with the perfect formula for ruling countries, and we must persuade or force every country in the world to accept this wonderful formula. It's not just now that people are rebelling against this. There have always been people who see the corporate interests, the economic interests that override what we pretend to be our interests, which are to bring human rights and civilization and peace to the rest of the world. So to try to show this commitment, this other side of the United States as a long continuum that has been going on for more than 100 years, I wanted to delve into what people thought and said back at the moment when the United States made that fateful decision to go from being a continental empire inside the United States to being an overseas empire that would take over other countries.
So there's always been this kind of opposition for over 100 years. And let's talk about some key examples of some interventions that may have been framed as successful at the moment, but as you have argued, history goes on. So what about the case of Iran in 1953 and the subsequent impacts not only in Iran, but the rest of the region?
As you point out, the United States has so much power that when we decide we want to depose a government, we can do it. And certainly during the Cold War, we did it regularly and pretty easily. So that's a success. We set out to do it, and we do it. We want to get rid of a leader, and we get rid of him. But success becomes failure over years. And many of these interventions that seem successful at the time wind up not only devastating the target country, but also undermining the security of the United States. Iran is a perfect example. We're now engaged in this long back and forth shouting match with Iran. But I don't think many Americans understand that this all began not with the hostage crisis in 1979, but far before that in 1953. In the period after the Second World War, Iran had developed an incipient democracy. Because that government was democratic, it had to respond to the needs and the desires of the Iranian people. At that moment, there was one huge fact of life in Iran. It overwhelmed everything. It was that Iran is sitting on an ocean of oil, but all that oil is owned by one British company, which in turn is owned by the British government. It was natural that when a democratic government came to power in Iran, that would be the number one priority. Take back control of our oil so we can use the proceeds to develop our own country. Once the Iranian government did that, the outside world went into a panic. In 1953, the CIA, in cooperation with the British Secret Service, overthrew the government of Iran. And that wasn't just the overthrow of a single leader. It was the destruction of democracy in Iran forever, right up until this day. So that overthrow seemed like a success at the time in 1953. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, the old prime minister, Mossadegh, and we replaced him with a guy who would do everything we wanted. That was the Shah. So that seemed fine, but over 25 years, the Shah ruled with increasing repression. That repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution, as we call it. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American mullahs who have spent the last 40 years working intently and sometimes very violently to undermine American interests all over the world. That revolution also had huge other impacts. It terrified the Soviet Union because they were afraid radical Islam would penetrate their own Muslim republics. That's what led the Soviets in part to invade Afghanistan, which is what brought us into Afghanistan. We were also so angry at Iran for overthrowing our Shah that we began supporting Saddam Hussein in Iraq when he invaded Iran. That was the beginning of our death embrace with Saddam that led us into the quagmire in Iraq that we're still into. So a lot of history came from about 3 weeks in the summer of 1953. The event that seemed like such a brilliant success at the time, the overthrow of Iranian democracy, has led us now into decades of trouble, and it's still going on. The effects of that intervention are still reverberating, and it's a perfect example of how operations that make us feel good for a few minutes actually wind up being bad for everybody.
And apparently that operation led to an operation the next year in 1954. In Central America. Now, the United States had long bullied its neighbors in Latin America, but that history is also not known in this country, and then we fail to understand why so many people are fleeing poverty, violence, and oppression. So what happened in Guatemala in 1954 and then through the 1980s that helps explain the refugee crisis today?
The United States' relationship with Central America has been very troubled and pained over more than a century. We've always considered the Central American countries to be, as we charmingly call them, banana republics, countries that need to do our bidding, small nations that essentially exist as fiefdoms for private American corporations. This is what Guatemala was up until the mid-1940s. United Fruit Company was the overwhelming fact of life in Guatemala. It owned the only electric company. It owned the only port from which products could be exported from Guatemala. It owned most of the arable land and had far more power than the Guatemalan government. In 1944, the old dictatorship was overthrown in Guatemala and democracy arrived. A similar process unfolded as was unfolding in Iran. The fact that you had a democracy in Guatemala meant that the government was finally going to have to respond to the needs of its people. Guatemalans were starving by the tens of thousands from lack of land. United Fruit had 500,000 acres of land that it didn't use. So a Land Reform Act was passed in which United Fruit was required to sell its unused land to the Guatemalan government for distribution among landless peasant families. This terrified the United States. We got so angry that we determined to crush Guatemalan democracy. The fact that we'd been able to do this so easily the year before in Iran just gave momentum to this project. And sure enough, in 1954, the CIA organized a coup called Operation Success, in which the last democratic government Guatemala ever knew was overthrown. That produced the beginnings of a civil war that lasted for 30 years. Some 200,000 Guatemalans, mostly civilians from the Maya Indian area, were slaughtered. That's more people than were killed in political violence in the entire rest of Latin America during that period. This would never have happened had the United States not intervened, if we had allowed the democratic processes in Guatemala to mature. But we couldn't do that because allowing democracy to flourish in Guatemala and allowing capitalism to grow in Guatemala would be a threat to American corporate capitalism. So our unwillingness to share the wealth and to accept the idea that countries that produced resources have a right to benefit from those resources led us to crush governments and leaders who embodied what we like to think of as American ideals and replace them with tyrants who despise everything the United States is supposed to stand for.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, award-winning journalist and author of many books about U.S. interventions around the world. Stephen Kinzer, just given this long history of how so many years of interventions have proved to be failed policy, why does the United States continue these interventions?
It's a very interesting question that people in the international relations business are often pondering. I think a big part of the reason has to do with the pressure in Washington that is exercised by foreign governments through think tanks and by the arms industry. The weapons industry in America is enormously powerful. Not only does it sponsor campaigns for members of Congress, who then go on to vote for extremely expensive military procurement projects, but it does something even more pernicious. Whenever a big defense contractor gets a contract for some new weapon system, the first thing it does is it divides up the contract into subcontracts, and it puts those subcontracts into factories that are in the districts of all the members of Congress whose votes they need. Therefore, these members of Congress come to realize that if they vote against a hugely wasteful military procurement project, they're costing hundreds of people in their district jobs. So this is a highly effective system that has brought tremendous power to the arms industry and made it seem like a crime in Washington to suggest that the exercise of military power all over the world is not good for the United States. Now, I will say that I think in recent years, there has been a substantial change in the attitude of the American people toward these interventions. I think the disasters of Iraq and Afghanistan and other foreign adventures have really sobered many Americans. In addition, we look around our own country, we see how many crying needs we have at home, and we wonder how urgent it is that we have to bomb other countries into accepting our political system when our own system doesn't work very well at home. Unfortunately, the change in mentality that has taken over in the American public, and which is confirmed by repeated public opinion surveys, has not penetrated Washington. You haven't seen much of a change there. There's some. There's now a new think tank in Washington called the Quincy Institute. It's the first one that tries confront the right-wing and left-wing and Democratic and Republican coalition in favor of war and intervention. There are a few members of Congress who are speaking up now. But no doubt the American people, as is probably often the case, are ahead of Congress on this one.
Right. And just witness the last Pentagon budget that, you know, continues to increase despite the claims that we're pulling out of Afghanistan and pulling back some of these interventions to appease the American public, where there is growing opposition to these kinds of allocations of resources. Well, thank you so much, Stephen Kinzer, and really encourage listeners to read more of your work. You can find out about Stephen Kinzer's work at stephenkinzer.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm your master of war. You that build the big gun. You that build the death plane. You that build the big bomb. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind death. I just want you to know I can see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build and destroy. You play with my world like it's your.
This is KBOO Portland. You are tuned into the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Bob Dylan, live 1994, Masters of War. The climate crisis is dramatically shaping the work environment for essential workers. As state leaders call Oregon's extreme heat waves and historic wildfires across the West a harbinger of things to come, what can workers do to rise up and fight for worker safety and protection across industries? Sarah Chivers talks with Anthony Carter, an essential worker in Portland.
The climate crisis is dramatically shaping the work environment for essential workers. Current reports are of a mass casualty event, that over 100 people died from the 115-degree heat we experienced in early July from hyperthermia, a condition of having a body temperature well above normal. As state leaders call Oregon's extreme heat waves and historic wildfires across the West a harbinger of things to come, what can workers do to rise up and fight for worker safety and protection across industries? Today I'm speaking with Anthony Carter, an essential worker on the front lines in Portland. Anthony, you've been working at your job for 6 years. Can you tell us about what it has been like over the last year during the COVID pandemic?
You know, I think like the way it's been for pretty much everybody, it's been stressful. The difference being that whereas a lot of people ended up working from home or not having enough work, we were still going to work and we were able to get outside and, you know, we were still seeing our coworkers. And even if that was the only social contact we had, you know, we had that. As far as my job, in the beginning, it just, once again, it was just more stress and more regulations and nobody knowing what to do. Masks, sanitation, more policies trickling down every day. Those got implemented pretty fast. But I think on the work end of it, because everybody was at home ordering online, like, you know, things that they normally would just go out to get, our workload started going through the roof. And, you know, staffing got a little difficult. More people started, you know, not at my office particularly, but citywide, I heard about people getting too afraid to do their routes and staying at home. And then that created more work for everybody else. And, you know, in my office, a couple people, they contracted COVID or at least had the possibility of contracting it from trace contacting. And And so that affected staffing with us. And, you know, at my job, if one person's not there, other people have to do that much more work. So quite frankly, for the past year, we're up until recently, we've all been pretty burnt out and just feeling like we didn't get a break. You know, like the spring at my job is normally where we get a time to rest and recuperate after the big Christmas push, and that didn't happen this year. And it's like I said, it's been only the last month or two that we've really like gotten back to normal, so to speak, in terms of like our workload.
So what was it like working in 115 degree heat last week and during the historic fires of last fall?
Start with the fires. That was rough. I remember the first day of the smoke started kind of descending on like my route. I remember distinctly realizing my body wasn't getting enough oxygen per breath. And like when I was walking, that was affecting how much power I could exert with my muscles. And then over the next few days, you know, some of my coworkers started talking about like their stinging eyes and I could smell the smoke. And for a few days, I could definitely tell my lungs were working harder. You know, eventually I got some N95 masks just for the forest fire smoke. And that helped for sure. But, you know, we were still out in that. That was not a fun time. I don't want to have to go through that again, but it kind of sounds like we're gearing up to this year. And as far as the 115 degree heat, absolutely not alone in saying nobody should have been out in that. Or if we had to, you know, with my job where we deliver, say, medications, that's a hard call because, you know, it's not my place to talk about what should or shouldn't have happened. I can say it was hard being out there. And as the day went on, you know, I could feel myself getting slower and slower just because the heat was getting to me so much. And I could feel my body going, if you move any faster than this, you're going to fall over. And I could not stay cool for the life of me. And, you know, I had to duck into air-conditioned buildings a couple times. At one point, I was literally, like, dousing myself with ice water. And then after a while, you realize there is, like, literally nowhere to get away from the heat. And that was a hard day.
So your vehicles don't have air conditioning?
They do not.
So you're delivering in 115-degree heat, trying to seek moments of coolness to just get your work done?
Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's a little different because unlike most of my coworkers, I've got my route's mostly walking. So I was out in it. But then, you know, you're ambulating and you're raising your own body temperature. But that's part of the demands of my job. And I think just over time and having been in Portland, you know, for like a lot of people who've been here for even more than a few years, we've gotten used to kind of enjoying those really temperate summers where it's, you know, 80 is like a hot day, and now it's like, you know, 80 seems like air conditioning. And, you know, even when I was working in 93 a few days ago, I was like, this is nothing, you know.
That sounds like a tremendous challenge and something that our local and federal leaders need to address. According to the Department of Labor, hazard pay is additional pay for performing hazardous duty or work involving physical hardship. Work duty that causes extreme physical discomfort and distress, which is not adequately alleviated by protective devices, is deemed to impose a physical hardship. The Fair Labor Standards Act does not address the subject of hazard pay, except that it requires hazard pay be included as part of a federal employer's regular rate of pay in computing the employee's overtime pay. So, Anthony, with the increasing workload and climate risks we face in the Pacific Northwest, how has your employer responded or supported workers? Have you received any hazard pay?
With the climate risks, I mean, my job it's pretty strict. You show up, you know, the only times we've ever been called off for work is during extreme weather conditions in the winter where they just realize, especially where my office is, you know, a lot of our routes are really hilly and more people are just going to slide off the road or get stuck. But heat isn't really something, you know, up until that day where we've ever been called back. And that was the first time in my life, you know, granted over a very short career so far, that I've ever been called back because of the heat. And as far as things that are in place, one person was telling me that they'll just make more concessions to get us back to the station earlier. But that's not an official statement. That's just more talking to one employee. And, you know, they give us things to help us deal with the, you know, they remind us to hydrate. Most of us have some kind of like, you know, really heavy duty thermos filled with ice water. I put a few bottles of water in a freezer and they bring extra bottles of water. And they give us scarves we can dip in ice water and wrap around our necks or, you know, like put on our head to help keep cool. But after a while, especially when you get into 115 degree heat, once again, there's only so much you can do and only for so long before you're just too hot. And then when you talk about hazard pay, I guess that is out of my employer's control as to decide as whether we get that. That has to be voted in by other governmental bodies that nobody at my job has the as far as I'm aware, has the ability to vote in. So, and also to answer your question, no, we have not gotten hazard pay. Hmm. Not for working through the pandemic, forest fires, or for 115 degree heat.
Wow. During the pandemic, hazard pay has been provided to certain essential workers whose jobs duties must be performed on site and therefore may have a higher risk of exposure to COVID from the public or coworkers. So far in California, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association is the only state government union to bargain successfully for pandemic-related hazard pay. California might have more money available to give bonuses to other employees through a $26 billion federal COVID-19 relief package that was passed in March, and that law allows governors to distribute hazard pay bonuses. Some employers have offered hazard pay to employees voluntarily in states like Pennsylvania and Vermont. There are grants available to help employers provide hazard pay to essential workers. In May 2020, the HEROES Act was passed, and it provides the Postal Service with $25 billion for revenue foregone due to the coronavirus pandemic. And in Oregon, nursing home workers with SEIU 503 won a 2.5% incentive for PTO and hazard pay for nursing facility workers. Anthony, what do you think would be the most useful policies, federal, state, or voluntary through employers, to help workers like yourself survive our growing climate risks?
That's a good question. You know, I can't really speak for my employer at all, but I can say I hope this doesn't sound too silly, but I think that the biggest thing is that we don't see employment as, or rather people as basically simply just employment. We have to see them as people that, you know, have lives, have families, and you know, we just need to make sure that everybody can be safe in that kind of heat, in a forest fire. And whether or not we have a job, the thing that matters the most is whether the person gets home safely and in the same condition they got into work in. I think that's the most important thing. If you can somehow turn that into a policy, more power to you.
Yeah, hopefully people not going to work and dying because of the conditions of their work is a key goal here.
Amen.
Hopefully this discussion can open the door to conversations and collective action across unions, sectors, and industries that will support all workers. Thank you so much, Anthony, for sharing your labor story with us today.
Thank you for having me here.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl.
This is KBOO Portland in the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was the Weapon Spoonful, Summer in the City. Concluding our program today, Bill Resnick talks with Joe Marie Bird of the Washington Office on Latin America about the ominous situation in Peru, where a right-wing party has refused to accept a national election defeat, adopting Trump's strategy and rhetoric that the voting was fraudulent, that they won the election. They've appealed to the army that has considerable right-wing leadership to recognize their candidate as the new president. If this succeeds with Trump's blessing, especially if the right takes over in the U.S., this could become the game plan for the international right to annul the election and run the country in partnership with the army and police. Then, after rendering the left impotent, call another election. Bill and Joe Marie Burt conclude by discussing what can be done to defeat this strategy.
Hi, Jo Marie Burke. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here with you today.
Jo Marie Burke is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Shire School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, a Senior Fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. She lived in Peru during the very corrupt and murderous Alberto Fujimori years. She wrote the definitive book on the Fujimori regime. It's titled Political Violence and the Authoritarian State in Peru, Silencing Civil Society. She was an international trial observer to the criminal prosecution of Alberto Fujimori, who fathered Keiko Fujimori, who we will discuss today, as one of the candidates in Peru's recent election, an election that has enormous international importance. So, Jo Marie Burke, tell us about the recent election in Peru and the aftermath, and then we can discuss why the outcome of the struggle now is so important.
Thanks for having me on again, Bill. So it has been more than 1 month since the second round presidential vote in Peru, which took place on June 6th, pitting two candidates against each other. They couldn't be more different, perhaps. You have the hard right Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of, as you said, the former dictator of Peru, Alberto Fujimori, between 1990 and 2000, who is a staunch defender of free market neoliberal economics and sort of get tough policies on crime, drugs, all the maladies of our modern societies, versus Pedro Castillo, a virtual unknown, a rural school teacher from northern Peru, Cajamarca. He's a rondero, which is someone who participates in these local rural civil defense patrols because there's really been, for many decades, very little state presence. So communities have organized themselves to protect themselves from thieves and other, you know, social ills. And he's a trade unionist. He's been active in the Peru's largest trade union, the teachers union. And he briefly had a moment in the national spotlight in 2017 when he led a national teacher strike. But really, he's made no real forays into electoral politics. He sort of jumped right into the presidential first round election when there were 18 candidates, not very appealing. Castillo, who was the highest vote getter, only got 15%. Keiko Fujimori only got 10%. But that was enough to put them into the second round against each other. So in the end, after the vote took place, Pedro Castillo was, he leads Keiko Fujimori by a very narrow margin, around 44,000 votes. But Keiko Fujimori has cried fraud, sort of stealing a page out of the Donald Trump playbook. She's claiming that there was fraud in these elections, systematic organized fraud. And she was demanding a recount of several tens of thousands of votes, mostly rural votes. She's basically trying to have votes for Pedro Castillo disqualified. So until all of these claims of fraud and the appeals have been exhausted, the elections authority cannot proclaim a winner. So literally, it's been over a month since the election and less than 3 weeks before the new president has to be sworn in on July 28th. So it's a very tense and uncertain moment in Peru. It has given rise to mass demonstrations on both sides. Pedro Castillo's voters have come out massively. In fact, many have traveled from remote rural areas to Lima to protect their vote, while members of Keiko Fujimori's party have also protested and demonstrated, claiming fraud, also claiming that they want their vote to be respected. So it's given rise to increasing tension, and there's a real threat of violence. There have been talks of military intervention. But yeah, it's a very, very tense moment.
My understanding is that Peru's conservative big media, not citing any evidence nor checking with any of the election observers, Peru's national media vehemently supported Fujimori's claims. But the election observers, some of them with really good reputations, and some of the others whose reputations are not so good, they declared the election was clean and Castillo won a narrow victory.
Yes, there were both international and national election observers. There were something like 30 different observation missions across the country. Perhaps the most important one being the Organization of American States, which routinely conducts elections observations throughout the Americas. And they and the other elections observer missions have all declared that these were free, fair, and transparent elections. In fact, the United States State Department actually emitted a statement praising Peru for carrying out what they called model elections. And I think it's important to note that in 2000, when Alberto Fujimori was, it was the end of his second term in office, and he was running for what was essentially a third but unconstitutional term in office, there were, in fact, mass allegations of systematic fraud. The Organization of American States, the OAS, was in Peru at that time, and they actually pulled their observers in the second, or before the second round, or just after the second round vote, declaring that there had been fraudulent elections and that they did not recognize these as clean and fair elections. The United States government did the same, also declared that these were fraudulent elections. So Peru knows what fraudulent elections look like. And in fact, after Fujimori fled the country a few months after that, in November of 2000, and an interim democratic government was put in place, one of the first things that that government did was to rebuild Peru's elections institutions to ensure that such fraud could not happen again. And so as a result, Peru's elections authorities are actually among the most fair, clean, and transparent in the world. When Keiko Fujimori's teams of very expensive lawyers brought claim after claim of fraud, you know, for example, they claimed that the signature was not the same as the signature on the individual's official government document. Those hearings were streamed via, I guess, Zoom or whatever platform they use, but it was streamed online so you could actually sit in and watch as the elections authorities listened to both sides' claims of fraud, ballot by ballot. Very transparent process. So, yeah, your sense is right that the elections observations teams have all declared that this was a free and fair elections process, and there is no real evidence of fraud. One by one, the elections authorities reviewing the Fujimori team's claims of fraud have discarded them literally one by one. And they, at this point, only have a few remaining voting tallies to review. And they've stated that within the next week or so, they should be proclaiming Peru's next president, which will be Pedro Castillo, because there's not enough question votes to change the results. Again, the results are very narrow, 44,000 votes, very, very narrow. However, in a democratic process, it's 50% plus one.
What about the Peruvian army? Armies are often quite conservative, and power in the society resides in the capacity to control the military. What's happening with them? Are there struggles in the military between those who would prefer living in a sort of semi-democratic state with vast extremes of wealth, but them doing well, and those who want to squash the left completely?
Yeah. Before we get to the military and the church, maybe we could talk a little bit about how the Fujimori campaign, in close alliance with other right-wing parties and the mainstream media, launched a relentless red-baiting campaign against Pedro Castillo, who is, you know, a self-proclaimed Marxist. His political party, Perú Libre, has a fairly radical political program. They want to change the constitution, a constitution that was the result of a coup d'etat by Keiko Fujimori's father, tailored to his needs, enshrines neoliberal economics as sort of the status quo, and changing the economic policies to favor Peru's vast majority of the population who are poor. So there's just been a lot of red baiting, and the mainstream media has gone along with this. The mainstream media, I think it's important to say this, 80% of the media in Peru is controlled by one economic group, El Comercio. So it's virtually, it's almost a monopoly. It's an oligopoly, but it's virtually a monopoly. And so the mainstream media fell in line one by one behind Keiko Fujimori. They portrayed her in very positive terms. They gave her ample play on media. The pundits on the nightly news were overwhelmingly favorable to Keiko Fujimori and overwhelmingly critical of Pedro Castillo. And it's really only because there are a lot of independent digital-based reporters and platforms in Peru, like IDL Reporteros and Ojo and Convoca and so on, La Mula, that Peruvians were able to access more accurate coverage. But, you know, as we know, that media is not often accessible to people in, you know, far off remote rural areas where often there's not even electricity. But getting back to the armed forces question, certainly the armed forces in Peru, I imagine, are not very favorable upon the idea of a leftist Marxist candidate. The armed forces in Latin America are very anti-communist, very favorable towards the status quo. However, the recent history of the Peruvian military has to be taken into account. The Peruvian military were marshaled by Alberto Fujimori into performing the role of his political party during the entire 1990s. When Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori, I'm talking about Keiko Fujimori's father, when he was elected president in 1990, he had really no political party to draw upon to govern the country. And so he drew on the advice and connections of a retired army captain who'd actually been in prison for selling secrets to the CIA as his interlocutor with the Peruvian military. So the Peruvian military was thoroughly politicized during the Fujimori era and thoroughly corrupted. The Fujimori era was the most corrupt government in Peruvian history, and the Peruvian military fell victim to this. And as a result, there are dozens of senior military officials from the Peruvian era who either were in jail or are still in jail because of corruption. And so when Peru transited to democracy in 2000, there was an effort to reestablish civilian control over the military. And that's never really been, I actually should say established, because there's never really been strong civilian control over the Peruvian military. Even in the 80s, when Peru had, you know, a formal elected democracy, the military still was very, very powerful. However, I think a good signpost is what happened in Peru in September of 2020. There were some members of Congress, conservative members of Congress, some of them connected to very corrupt networks, who were trying to remove the standing president at the time. And one of those individuals, Manuel Merino, who was the president of Congress, actually began contacting members of the high commands of the armed forces, asking them to ally the army with the members of Congress who were trying to remove the standing president. And the army, first of all, ignored the overtures and reported them to the Minister of Defense, which is exactly what you want an armed forces in a democratic context to do. And then the Minister of Defense denounced this, and the government reaffirmed and rebuffed the overtures of Congressman Marino. So it remains an issue, but to date, the military remains firmly under civilian control. And my hope is that it remains such.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Joe Marie Burt, who teaches politics and Latin American studies at George Mason University, co-director of the Center for Global Studies. We've been discussing the recent elections in Peru, where the right-wing candidate Keiko Fujimori is contesting the very narrow victory of a left reformist candidate. Keiko Fujimori adopted the Trump playbook of claiming fraud and whipping up her supporters, some of them top people in the military. Joe Marie Burt, it seems to me, the history of Latin American elections and politics can't be understood without considering the U.S. intervention into Latin American politics and even its elections under either Democratic or Republican presidents up to this day. Thus, in one of the latest and most terrible U.S. interventions in Latin America, Obama, his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and the national security apparatus, they gave the green light to the U.S.-trained and armed Honduran military to arrest and exile Honduras's democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya. And then the Honduran military and death squads went on a killing and imprisoning spree, targeting labor union and environmental activists and leaders. I wonder, what's been the U.S. response? Trump, of course, warmly welcomed Keiko Fujimori to Washington. She was pictured all over the newspapers talking to Rudy Giuliani about crime and how to deal with crime. Keiko has all the authoritarian tendencies that Trump seems to delight in. But, of course, now we have a new regime. How are they dealing with the Peruvian election?
I don't think that the United States government, the Biden administration, any U.S. administration would feel terribly comfortable with the Pedro Castillo presidency. He's a known Marxist. His party's alliances have been historically with governments that we have troubled relationships with, particularly Venezuela and Bolivia. Under, you know, Chavez Maduro in Venezuela and Evo Morales, and now there's a new government under Arce in Bolivia. However, I think that the U.S. government's approach under Biden has been focusing on process. And I think that's extremely important because this same thing happened to Biden. Keiko Fujimori is trying to do in Peru what Donald Trump did in the United States in 2020, which is claim victory, claim that there was fraud, claim that she was the actual victor, and steal the elections from Pedro Castillo. She says he stole the elections from her, but in fact, she's trying to steal the elections from him. And the Biden administration, taking its cue from these other international observation and domestic observation missions, has very clearly stated that the election process in Peru is free and fair. They noted that they are also on the ground tracking what's happening, and they declared a model election process. So they're trying to hold the line on tactics by, you know, right-wing authoritarians like Keiko Fujimori, who through lies and mass media manipulation are trying to steal elections. And I think that is very important. Certainly the U.S. has a long history of intervention in the United States, and I don't by any means want to discount the importance of that legacy. But right now the U.S. is adopting the correct posture in Peru, which is Pedro Castillo was elected free and fair. We must respect those results. We will find a way to work with his government. And then we'll see what happens, right? I think that, but the importance of ensuring that the electoral process is respected seems to me to be first and foremost in the U.S.'s approach to Peru. And I think that's very positive. If Trump were the president, I have no doubt that it would be the exact opposite. I have no doubt that Trump would give full airing to Keiko Fujimori's lies of fraud and would actively be supporting her.
We've gotten to the final issue. I see this struggle in Peru as extremely important in international politics, and in that if Keiko, in fact, somehow manipulates in one way or another her candidacy, she will, for one thing, free her father from prison, who was convicted of genocide, basically, lots of murders. But not only that, it would reinforce the authoritarian trends all over the world of authoritarian leaders taking over and they're refusing to leave office regardless. That's going to be a struggle, actually, for quite a while around the planet. Trump, in fact, could run for office, or Trumpy could, and in fact, take power if the economy goes bad in the United States in the next 2 years. Certainly, they're planning on it. How do you see that struggle going on, and what can ordinary U.S. people do?
You know, Bill, I think that you're right. I think Peru is a bellwether. It's an indicator of future trends for Democrats around the world. Can a right-wing authoritarian leader perpetuate lies, manipulate the media to an extent that they can overturn or otherwise manipulate the results of an election, deny the winner his proper, you know, his assuming the presidency and herself take office? I think that if Keiko Fujimori's plan, and it's important to know she has multiple plans, there are multiple front lines on which she and her people are working to ensure that Pedro Castillo does not become president of Peru. If she triumphs in this effort, it will be a very troubling indicator for democracy around the world. Because what she is essentially doing is subverting the electoral process and Peru's very democracy. So if she succeeds, what it means is that authoritarianism will be installed in Peru, and other authoritarians, not only in Latin America, but around the world, will learn from her and will pursue similar tactics to ensure their power in their own country. So I do think that what happens in Peru matters not only for millions of Peruvians. And I am hopeful, but we are seeing many examples of the resiliency of Peru's democratic institutions. It is my hope that they will succeed in defeating this authoritarian takeover attempt by Keiko Fujimori. But there are still concerns, I think, and it's important for us to continue to watch. You can contact your senators, your members of Congress, members of the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee issued a statement a week or so ago calling on Peru to uphold the election results and ensure a smooth transition, denouncing the election's, you know, fraud, the fraudulent claims of fraud by Keiko Fujimori and so forth. So we can play a role here in the United States by supporting democracy and calling on our representatives and our government to support democracy around the world.
Yes, for sure. No doubt phone calls succeed sometimes when our representatives and the government see it as possibly in their and the country's interests, and that the democratically elected leftist is flexible and ready to compromise and accept the political and economic constraints imposed by the U.S. and Western powers. But in cases where the Latin America country's leadership and their and the political movement they represent is serious about enforcing labor rights or raising taxes on corporate interests or, God forbid, nationalizing oil or the energy industry, that's another story. Keeping the U.S. corporate and political elite at bay stops them from deposing leaders and smashing movements they don't like by one means or another. That takes more than phone calls, but still phone calls can help when there's enough of them. So I often make my calls to our senators and representatives. Joe Marie Burt, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. It was a real pleasure being with you here today.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kullberg produced today's program. Thanks to all our regulars and their guests, Old Moles Laura Mercier, Sarah Chivers, Bill Resnick, along with John Nelson, who produced Bill's interview, and their respective guests, Stephen Kinzer, Anthony Carter, and Joe Marie Burt. Many KBO listeners know about the struggle in northern Minnesota to stop Enbridge's Line 3, the pipeline expansion carrying the highly toxic tar sands oil from Canada through critical waterways and tribal lands in the Midwest. That struggle is at a critical juncture. Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people have led this frontline resistance and continue to lay their bodies on the line, with hundreds getting arrested in recent weeks. Join 350 PDX and Extinction Rebellion today, July 12th at 3 p.m. at Seawall Crest Park in Southwest Portland, as part of a week of actions organized by StopTheMoneyPipeline.com. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast for the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via KBOO webpage or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's perspective, which is also the perspective of the people, that is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland.